Our next case is 2020-1163 in re the adoption of AK for the appellant. Ms. Clark, you are presenting, is that correct? You'll have to turn your microphone on.
That is correct, Your Honor.
All right, proceed.
Thank you. If it may please the court, my name is Rebecca Clark, and I'm here today on behalf of the petitioners and the appellants in this case. We are here today because we've learned that any tool can be a weapon if it's held correctly. In this particular case, the 8th District's broad application of the holdings in In Re BI affect very directly and distinctly the lives and the safety and the discretion that this court has previously found to be applicable in adoption cases. In Re BI had to do with a child support order, an obligation by the respondent to pay a certain amount of money in the year prior to the filing of the petition for the adoption. In Re AK has to do with the duty to communicate in the year prior to the filing of the petition. These facts are entirely separate. The discretion that the probate court has in these two matters are entirely separate. And so therefore, the facts of this case of In Re AK and In Re BI are not clearly aligned. They are not in any way actually aligned, other than they have to do with the duty or the obligation upon the respondent. By this broad application given by the 8th District Court of Appeals, it will undermine all of the Ohio legislative intent of creating a duty to communicate and create a blanket justification for a parent, a natural parent, to avoid the natural consequences of his or her own actions and prevent the better interests of the children in permitting an adoption to proceed. This application of In Re BI.
Counsel, wouldn't we be undermining the goal of people following court orders?
Court orders are issued for a reason, Your Honor. And they are given at that time consideration by the court that issues that order. And in the issue of no contact orders specifically, we're talking about the conduct of the parent that led a court to believe that their contact in some manner, like every no contact order is different, but that some manner of contact would be detrimental to the minor child. So the specific language of the no contact order is very important. This in Re AK, it prevented contact with the minor children. It did not prevent indirect contact. It didn't prevent the ability of the respondent to speak with the caretakers, the legal custodians, the family members, the schools. It didn't prevent any part of that communication, which would express an interest, which would express a desire.
The order was not stated in terms of finality. In other words, the order could have been modified. There was an option to petition the court, was there not?
Yes, Your Honor. It actually stated until further order of the court. And that's an important element, obviously, for our argument, that this order was modifiable at any point between when custody was granted to the petitioners in 2007 and the filing of the petition for adoption in 2015, the respondent had every opportunity to seek that order to be modified, to express an interest, to have contact, to take some action. And this is an affirmative action, right? The respondent does not get to sit back and force upon the petitioner to prove each and every element beyond just that there was a failure. If they don't put on a prima facie case of justification, then the petitioner can stop once they prove a failure. In this case, by this broad application from the 8th District, you're allowing the respondent, who is the party to a court order that was of their own, something of their own action, to sit back and rest on that, right? That a court said that I shouldn't have contact, and therefore I don't have to express any interest in these children or this child.
The court didn't say I shouldn't have contact. The court said I must not have any contact.
And left that modifiable to the change of circumstances.
So if there had been an application to modify and that had been denied, then what about your other arguments about indirect contact or inquiry?
If that had been the case, then that would be a prima facie case of justifiable cause. The same way unclean hands doctrine applies here, right? If a respondent makes an attempt to reach out to their children when there is no court order denying it, and the custodian stands in the way, doesn't pass along the messages, plays the game of hide and seek, as we've seen in some of the cases, then that is held against the petitioner for unclean hands. So had the respondent in this case ever moved, and there are several good cases that talk about if they make the effort, what is the consequence of that? And the courts have found repeatedly that the failure to make any effort speaks volumes about the actual rights of the parent versus the needs of the child.
But why is this different when, from in BI, when this court found that there was no duty to pay child support, to support the child, when the court had an order that said, you don't have to support your child?
There are several facts
I think that this court construed that order as, don't support your child.
And in that particular case, looking at the facts of that case, that was an agreed entry between the parents. Mother actually is the one that petitioned the lower court to modify child support to zero and to terminate the obligation. She then married and asked the court for a step-parent adoption. There was no agreement between these parties.
But how does that make the orders different? They're still both court orders.
They are court orders, and they're both modifiable. And if mother had felt that support was necessary, when you look back at the Ohio legislature and why they put in the duty to support and why they then later added the duty to communicate, because they felt like these were very important elements in those parental rights, rights are based on action.
But you're saying both orders were modifiable, and in BI, the non-supporting parent didn't attempt to modify?
I think the difference is that there is a very logistical difference in the between child support and having contact with or making effort to have contact with a minor child.
But the contact here was ordered by the court there to be no contact for safety concerns, correct?
It was at that time. But understand that order was issued in 2007 and that the adoption wasn't filed until 2015. So in 7 years, while father was writing letters and expressing an interest, and that's the argument that was made, right? That he was willing but unable. He was able to send those letters to the grandparents, to the custodians. He was able to make contact with the schools. He just chose not to. And so the duty to communicate looks at that very specific order and says, you may not be allowed to do one thing. It doesn't mean you can't do anything. And that's what the difference is. It's that these court orders are very different. When you're looking at a court order, you should be able, and the probate court has been given great discretion in justifiable cause to make that final ruling. And they should be able to look at the underlying reason for a court order or any efforts that the parent made to either comply with that order and still have contact or to modify that order to adjust their contact. In this case, there isn't any effort. And the courts have found repeatedly that effort is important because it goes to the justifiable cause. It is the essence of the unclean hands.
The appellee seems to argue that because people like his mother or members of his family were spending time with his children, that they were acting maybe as a surrogate for him. What weight do we give that evidence?
It is the role of the parent, right? And the duty of the parent, not the duty of the family member. And so a family member may visit, may choose to go, may choose not to go. If he had asked the parent to go and they didn't, would that then be said that he was, you know what I mean, that he was making an effort and nobody was listening? I don't think there's any weight to be given to the role of family members who do things at your bidding or do them as they wish. It is the role of the parent. And if the parent sought that contact, he could have modified the order, made an attempt to contact the grandparents, made an attempt, did anything. He did literally nothing. And so you cannot replace him with a separate interest of a grandparent. That's why we have grandparents' rights that are separate from a parent's rights. because grandmother in and of herself did eventually seek grandparents' visitation and was awarded that entirely separate from the no contact order. So her actions and her interests are separate from his in a very legal way. And so I understand that she said she was doing it for her child, the parent, but there's no way to discern whether that was her interest or his.
Thank you.
So as to due process, and that's what we're looking at, right, is due process. Are the parents, the natural parents, afforded the rights that should be granted to them, at the same time balancing those needs of the children? And in many cases, we see the needs of the children, when they come into conflict, are actually held higher than the rights of the parent. So the protection is in place. There's an appropriate standard of proof in an adoption case. The standard of proof is clear and convincing evidence that not only has there been a failure, but if a case is made for justifiable cause, then that burden shifts back to the petitioner to then prove that that's not justifiable. So again, parents' rights are protected by this dual and increasing burden upon the petitioner. Another element due process is discretion. In re Massa, in re Adoption of Holcomb, talk about that discretion of the probate court. And the fact that the probate court is the trier of fact is held accountable to determine not only if there's a failure by clear and convincing, but whether or not there's justifiable cause. And that should not be disturbed by an appellate court minus the abuse of discretion. So we talk about how important that discretion is, and that discretion includes looking at a number of factors. Probate courts have considered all kinds of factors when looking at adoption cases, whether there was an attempt to modify, how close the petitioner lived to the respondent, and whether there was ever an attempt to reach out. They looked at whether or not, in some cases, they talked about the ignorance of the no contact. In re Adoption of Manier, which this court upheld, said that mother had an affirmative duty, if she didn't understand a court order or she hadn't read it, that ignorance is no excuse, and that she had the opportunity to modify and hadn't taken those actions. So we look very closely at that as a form of protection for both rights, parents, and needs of the child. The factor—
Counsel, yeah. you're into your rebuttal time, well into it.
Okay, then at this point, I'll rest. Thank you, Your Honors.
Thank you. Ms. Barrett.
Chief Justice O'Connor, may it please the court. My name is Mary Catherine Barrett, and I represent the father. The 8th District Court of Appeals got this right. To overturn this decision would be to contradict this court's decision in In re BI. It would allow the probate court's discretion to override the General Assembly's intent, and it would create chaos in the state courts. When can a parent rely on a valid court order? Your Honor,
let me ask you this. Isn't there a difference between the order and BI, which relieved the father of a legal obligation?
Yes.
Other than the order in this case, which is a direct prohibition.
Correct.
Brought about by his own conduct.
Yes, Your Honor. It is, like, if you look in In re BI, his own criminal conduct put him in jail as well. Yeah, which presumably led to the zero support order. Yet this court still held that he could rely on a valid court order that wouldn't terminate his parental rights in the adoption.
Well, in BI, wasn't the issue not justifiable cause, but the language in the statute that said, as provided by a court order? I mean, there was no real discussion in BI about the justifiable cause prong of the test.
No, I mean, there was in the dissents, whether or not the valid
court order— There wasn't the dissents, but the dissents aren't the law, so—
Yes, but whether the valid court order goes to duty or whether it goes to justifiable cause, we still need the father's consent for this adoption. It discusses his duty. It prevented him from the privilege of communicating.
Well, but again, didn't— This is what I'm confused about, because you seem to be arguing, and I think really all the parties and the court below talking about justifiable cause, but as I read the decision in BI, it didn't get to the justifiable cause prong. It only discussed the what it meant as provided by a court order.
But wouldn't this court order still describe his duty? you cannot communicate it. She brought in Ray Manier. That's not applicable in this case because
Right. But aren't those two different things? One is you have a duty, and but the second question under the statute is, if you didn't fulfill your duty, did you do so without justifiable cause or not?
Yes. If he has a court order saying he's not allowed to communicate, he can't rely on that court order.
He can have that court order or attempt to have that court order modified, and he chose not to do that for the almost 10 years involved here.
Yes, you can modify a court order if there's a change in circumstances. And case law says substantial change in circumstances. But Your Honor, appellants offered no evidence of a change of circumstance. Why? Because there was no change of circumstance to justify modifying this court order. The law does not make us do a futile act, State v. Madison. And In re Mesa stated, we don't ask the impossible as a condition of preserving a fundamental right. There was no change of circumstances. I think the big thing here is also
counsel, are you saying that never is a court petitioned to modify a court order and then leave it to the court to determine whether there's a change in circumstances?
There,
you're making a conclusion now, and there was no argument proffered by the defendant to the court to change those, you know, to change the order. You're saying right now, looking at it, there was no change in circumstances. Isn't that for the court to determine?
Yes, and there, and they offered no evidence of a change of circumstance.
Well, is that on that? That's not their duty here.
Why should we put it on the father to have his duty? We do not ask the impossible as a condition of preserving fundamental right. I think what's missing here is there was also a pattern of threatening with the appellants. They were very fearful. The father loved his children and he loved his mother and he wanted his mother to visit his children. At every turn, there was a pattern of threats and they would stop visitation. They were very fearful that visitation with the mother would once again be thwarted. If you look to our supplemental page 9-22, they stopped visits at the plea. They stopped visits at the appeal. They stopped visits at the name change, and they stopped visit with the grandmother for over a year and vigorously fought when we applied for visitation in the juvenile court. This was a real threat. Now, as you read, my client wrote over 200 letters. The 8th District, the magistrate, the probate court, everybody agreed that he was willing to communicate with his children. But for this court order, that's the definition of justifiable cause. I know we're in justifiable cause, not duty. However, had he mailed the 200 letters directly to the children, which the court order prevented, it was incorrect. It's not on the record for saying that he was able to mail these letters to her. The court order prevented that. Had he done that, we wouldn't be here today because he would have fulfilled his duty to communicate.
Counsel, could he have not sent those letters to the grandparents?
He would have violated the court order. They were very fearful to violate the court order because there was retaliation, and then the appellants would stop visitations with his mother, the grandmother.
Okay, but all right.
No, per the court order, he could not have mailed the letters to the girls. He would have been violating the court order.
To the grandparents, not to the children themselves.
No, they all live together. The grandparents have legal custody.
I understand that.
Okay. So the girls are severely autistic. The girls were living with the grandparents. If he would have mailed them to the girls, he would have mailed them to the grandparents' home.
I'm saying mailing the letters to the grandparents and allowing the grandparents to make a decision.
To understand the dynamics of the families involved, that would have definitely resulted in retaliation towards his mother and interrupting the visits with the girls.
So aside from
that, he was fearful of violating this court order.
Aside from that, Ms. Barrett, you essentially have two Court of Appeals decisions that are diametrically opposed. And so in order to get through the analysis of law of the case, BI would be the intervening factor that permitted the court to basically do an about face. Explain again for us just how that applies as an intervening factor.
It goes right to the heart of the conflict. Can a parent rely on a valid court order such that it won't terminate their parental rights? Or are they going to look to the underlying reason for a valid court order, which in essence terminates parental rights based on a crime? And the General Assembly vested that in 2151-414 with the prosecutors, with the county, in the juvenile court. The General Assembly chose to name over 50 crimes that the juvenile court could consider to terminate parental rights, not in the private sector in 3107 with a private adoption. If you look, my client committed a horrible crime. The criminal justice system did its job. At the same time, in the juvenile court, the professionals back in October in 2007 could have terminated his parental rights at that time in the proper court that would terminate parental rights based on a crime. But the professionals involved chose not to. Instead, they granted legal custody to the maternal grandparents, a no contact order to the father, leaving the very important family members intact. Now, why would they do that? Why wouldn't they just terminate parental rights and allow the grandparents to adopt at that time? We have two special needs. At the time it was two, AK is now aged out. Now there's one, CK is now 16. Two severely autistic children that are gonna need love, care, support the rest of their lives. Two families are better than one. We have two GAL reports, one from Summit County, one from Cuyahoga County, that determined the paternal grandmother, the former pediatric nurse, loves and is devoted to CK and has been their entire life. And the paternal relationships with CK are in CK's best interest, and we have a court order protecting those relationships. Why would the now?
Excuse me, but that was all in evidence in both cases. So I'm looking again at BI and explain to me how it's an intervening factor when you've got sort of apples and oranges. You have communication and you have support.
If you look to, okay, In re BI discusses a parent can rely on a valid court order such that it wouldn't terminate parental rights and allow an adoption go forward without their consent.
That deals with zero support, right?
Yes, his was zero support. So if you look to page 166 in Mesa, it does talk about the definition of justifiable cause. And it talks about support and communication apply equally to justifiable cause. And the Eighth District was correct when they upheld this court's prior ruling that there is no meaningful difference between communication and support as it's applied to justifiable cause or duty.
Counsel, let me go back to one thing you started with in my questioning, that there was a fear that the paternal grandmother would be precluded from seeing the girls or having contact had the father petitioned for a change of the court order.
Yes.
Okay. Yet the grandmother, the paternal grandmother, was protected by a court order establishing her visitation.
Yeah. So the time in question was June 2014 to June 2015. That was the 1 year look back period. That court order, we applied for visitation in the summer of 2015. They fought vigorously. We didn't get that court order to November of 2018, well outside the 1 year period, the look back period. So we were talking about, you know, we just got the court order November of 2018.
Who's we?
I also represent his mother.
Okay, thank you.
Yes. So the plain reading of the statute, Your Honors, compel the conclusion that the General Assembly intended no other crimes to be considered in 3107-07A. They name only one crime, which is murder of the mother? No. Is it abuse of the child? No. It's rape of the mother that led to the conception. This is not an oversight. The General Assembly did not intend to terminate parental rights based on a crime in the private sector adoption statute. The proper place to do that would be 2151414, the juvenile court with the prosecutor, with the county. And the prosecutor and the county and the professional involved at the time could have terminated parental rights in juvenile court, and they chose not to. This adoption is different. Most adoptions are about creating family ties. This adoption, because of the very unique circumstances, it's a grandparent adoption, only serves to sever grandma, grandpa, aunts, uncles, cousins to a child that really needs it. The rest of her life, she's never going to be independent. And it's 3107-15A. The person becomes a legal stranger to all former relatives. What might be the public policy behind this legislative intent? Let me tell you how this makes sense. How can we get a bad apple out, but yet leave the very important family members intact? 2151414 is a complex statute that allows for this. It allows for granting legal custody to a family member, a no contact order to the bad apple, and leaving the very important family members intact. Not an adoption. An adoption is black or white. It severs all family ties. However, adoptions are about creating family from strangers. And because of the unique fact pattern, the unique circumstances in this case, it serves only to sever an entire paternal side of CK's family. Family that loves her, cares about her, is devoted to her. To allow the probate courts now to look to the underlying reason for a valid court order opens up Pandora's box, Your Honors. It will create chaos in the state court. When can a parent rely on a valid court order? In Ray B, I spoke to the heart of the matter, the heart of the conflict in adoptions. Can they rely on a valid court order, or are the judges going to be allowed to look to the underlying reason for the court order? It would be in my client's best interest to have violated this court order, and we wouldn't be here today. He would have fulfilled his duty by violating a valid court order. What would be the motivation for someone in jail for a very long time to comply with the court order, especially if it means his family can't see the girls, his grandmother can't see the children? And we also have a due process consideration here. 2151414, which is the proper court to terminate parental rights based on a crime, allows for the judge, 22 points the judge must consider to terminate parental rights. That satisfies the due process. We don't have that in 3107. There's no due process considerations, and they only name one crime the judge can consider to terminate parental rights. Your Honor, I see my time is up.
It is.
Okay. We request you affirm the decision of the 8th District.
Thank you. Counsel.
Counsel for the respondent talks a lot about the facts of this case. And while they are very important because they distinguish this so distinctly from In Re BI, so as to defeat the intervening case designation, it's not just this case that we're talking about. We're talking about taking the law of In Re BI, which applied specifically to a child support order, and applying it so broadly to all the other factors of 3107.07. A, child support and the duty to communicate have actually been treated very separately in case law. The words de minimis were found to mean only an application to contact and not to child support. So the two things are not synonymous even in their treatment in the case law, because there are very distinct differences between a child support order and a duty to communicate. Counsel for the respondent, natural father, indicates that there's this threat of retaliation. Whether that's true or not, grandmother had separate legal rights from the day father was incarcerated until today. She didn't choose to pursue those rights until after the petition for adoption was filed. Quite similar to father's intent to communicate doesn't appear until after that petition is filed, which is 7 years after custody is granted. So why didn't the criminal court terminate father's parental rights? That's up to them. Why didn't the juvenile court do so? Because again, they gave an open door. They allowed father and his family to maintain that contact. They didn't pursue an adoption at the state's cost. Rather, once they secured the permanency and best interests of the minor children in the legal custody, they left that open for later actions.
Excuse me, Ms. McGuire, but evidence of the order that he was not permitted to have contact with the children, isn't that clear and convincing evidence which then shifts the burden to your clients to show that his justifiable cause really isn't clear and convincing evidence?
And right, and so we did, right? So then we put on the evidence that goes to other ways he could have communicated, the fact that he never moved to modify that order, the fact that he claims that there was this threat of retaliation, but it was from an email sent in 2008. We talked about all of those other factors. We absolutely put on that evidence because we felt very strongly that father had taken no action, given that opportunity by the juvenile court to modify that order to have contact. It doesn't require a change in circumstances as counsel had presented. It's an entirely different standard. But what we're asking—
Counsel, is there a financial benefit for the child here to be adopted by these grandparents?
There is potentially, and that was one of the reasons we sought that adoption. Okay. In fact, it had to do with their education and schooling in South Euclid versus the Hudson School District, but also long-term planning for the girls' long-term needs. So we're asking this court to remand back to the 8th District to find In Re BI is not an intervening case in these facts and contact in general, and to ask the 8th District to rule on the appeal that was before them, which was of the final decision in the best interest portion.
Thank you. Thank you. We'll take the matter under advisement. You'll be notified of our decision. Marshall, we call a 10-minute recess.
The court will now adjourn for a 10-minute recess.